No propaganda, no lies, and definitely no BS.
You're with George Eliason,
live from Donbash, Ukraine, on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
This is TNT Talk Radio. I'm your host, George Eliason, and we've got an exciting show today. Our special guest is Crystal Neant, who's a war correspondent on the front lines of the war in Donetsk. Crystal first arrived in Donetsk in March 2016, and she was given a trial-by-fire approach to frontline reporting with Donny Press Center. It was actually her first reporting job, corresponding job, and thrown right directly into the hot zone. She speaks three languages, French, Russian, and English, has a master's degree, and left a successful career before moving to Donetsk to report on the war. Now, Crystal has spent more time continuously on the front line than any other English-speaking journalist on either side. In her first 4 years, she went to the front over 150 times, 36 times at firing positions, and spent days at a time there. And she's an award-winning war correspondent. She's personally documented the civilian areas in Donetsk People's Republic, where the Ukrainian army was committing war crimes, shelling civilians, and there was no military targets there to begin with. Crystal, hi, welcome and hello.
Hi, George.
How are you today?
I'm fine. We still hear shellings occurring all around. It's quite a bit frightening, of course, but all is okay.
Well, let's start by describing the conditions in Donetsk over the last few weeks. Ukraine stepped up the shelling of civilian areas radically. What exactly is going on right now?
So it's around 3 weeks that the Ukrainian army increased really tenfold the shellings of not only Donetsk, but also Makiivka, Gorlovka, and Yasinovataya, which are cities which are still near the front lines, and they are shelling places that they did not shell before or not since 8 years, like the center of Donetsk, the center of Makiivka, and they used all the range of weapons that they have available, from the mortar to the multiple rocket launchers like Grad, like Huragans. And they use the new weapons mm-hmm. that were provided by NATO. That's the cannons of 155 millimeters provided by the USA and by France. It's obviously terror shelling. The aim is to terrorize the population. That's the first aim. The second aim, I think, is to destroy a maximum of infrastructure, because we see that they target administrative buildings, coal mine, schools, hospitals, kindergarten. They target really infrastructures. Yesterday, they targeted the area around the Donbass Arena Stadium in the center of Donetsk. So I think the aim is to inflict a maximum financial blow to Russia, because they know that Russia will pay to repair everything which was destroyed by the conflict. And I think the third aim is to try to push Russia and the DPR to divert some of the troops that they have currently more in the north, near Slavyansk, near Lysychansk, to try to slow down the current encirclement of Lysychansk. And they try to slow down by trying to divert troops to protect the Donetsk city and the Makiivka and Gorlovka. I think that's the aim.
That's a really good point, too. Now, what's the daily life like for people in the city under these conditions right now? Paint the picture for our audience.
It's really hard because it's really erratic, random shelling. So there is no safe place, and you don't know when it will begin and when it will end. We personally, with a colleague, spent 5 hours in a shelter a little bit more than 2 weeks ago in one of the periphery district of Donetsk. And we really thought at the end that we would sleep there because we didn't see any end to this shelling. And really, it takes you by surprise. I mean, yesterday they shelled Makiivka, even one of the central district of Makiivka. Makiivka is more on the east compared to Donetsk. So usually this town was more or less safe, and now it's not. And they shell sometimes just one or two rockets. That's what they did yesterday. They sent one Uragan in near the center of Makiivka. They sent one Grad in one of the district of Makiivka, which is near Donetsk. And that's all. So you don't understand. You just hear the whistling and the rocket is falling on you, and that's the end. So civilians are staying at home at maximum, but people have to go to work. They have to go to buy food. They have to go to take water because we have still problems to have water at the tap. So it's really, really hard. You have to go outside. You cannot stay at home 24 hours per day. But you don't know if something could happen because it can be calm in the morning and then in the afternoon it's hell.
Is it even worse on the front line towns right now?
Yes, of course. The districts of Donetsk, which are on the front line, or the towns like Gorlovka, which are also really near, or Yasinovataya, which are really near of the front line, it's really the worst place to be. That's where the shellings are the most intensive. But on this place, I would say it happened like it's already 8 years. So it was for them like a daily routine. So people do not pay much attention about that, which can be also dangerous. But the novelty is really that they are shelling like central district of Donetsk. They shelled the eastern district of Kalininsky, or even the Budyonovsky one, which is really far from the front. So for the moment, it's really bad. All the towns which are still, I would say, at fire range from the front line, it's really, really dangerous.
Now, a few weeks ago, the Ukrainians targeted your car when you and another reporter were working on a story. What happened?
So it was on the 4th of June. We learned in the morning that a woman, a civilian, was killed under shelling in the Petrovsky district of Donetsk. It is one of these districts which are really on the front line. We monitored. We saw that, okay, it seems the shelling has stopped. So we decided to go. We went there with a guy from the corpus, from the army, to be informed in case of the shelling is resuming. And in fact, the shelling resumed just when we arrived on site. So we arrived near the place where this woman died, near the mine Cheluskintsev, which is a coal mine. And we heard the whistling of the shelling. And so I stopped immediately the car and we jumped out of the car very quickly. We lay down on the ground and then we saw that there is a shop nearby. So we entered into it and we stayed there 5 hours. 1 hour in the shop and 4 hours in the basement, because after 1 hour, the shelling went really closer and closer to the shop, and the shop was hit directly. All the windows were completely shattered, and so we understood it was better to go in the old Soviet basement, which was under the shop, and we stayed there 4 hours. And the shelling was continuous for 5 hours of hell. All the cars which were in the area were completely destroyed. There were around, I think, 20 cars which were parked on the parking of the mine, because the miners came with their car, and all the cars were completely burned, completely destroyed. Not a single car was intact. I mean, yeah. So we evacuated. We were evacuated by the corpus, by the army, because I had no more car. My car was completely destroyed after 5 hours of shelling. You can imagine the state of it.
Right. I saw a picture of it. I mean, it's horrible. Now, yeah. If we go back to February, when Russia preempted the Ukrainian invasion, because Ukraine was coming over the line, they were going to invade in force. What was it like during the first few days when Russia came?
First, here we didn't see a huge difference, because it was already 1 week the Ukrainian army stepped up shelling to a huge scale. So when Russia intervened, it was already 1 week that we had really regular shelling, again against Donetsk, mm-hmm. against all these towns. But after a few days, when we saw that they advanced quickly in some areas, we saw that, okay, our Ukrainian army was diverted to this place. So after some times, we had a calmer situation here. First we didn't see the huge difference here. We saw a huge, there were huge artillery battles in the south of the DPR. So in Sakhanka, in Kominternovo, so on this line which was going to Mariupol. So because they advanced from this side, as well as they advanced from the Kherson region, from Crimea. So that's where we saw really a huge, huge increase in terms of danger. It was in this area in the south. On our side, at the beginning, it was not that that visible.
And that's was that where you were covering, was going south into toward Kherson during that period?
I was not in this area. I during this time I was still reporting about the shelling of civilian areas, mainly in Gorlovka.
What were you seeing there?
I've seen that Ukrainian army shelled schools. They have killed two teachers there. They shelled really places where there were only civilians, only houses, civilian housing buildings, schools. There was nothing military. And it was really, really hard, because when we arrived in Gorlovka, when this school was shelled, the corpses of the two teachers were still there. And it was really hard to see that. That's what I reported first, and after when the Allied forces advanced, then I went to the liberated place. But then it was in March. In March, then I began to go in other places like Granitnoye, and then Volnovakha, and then Mariupol.
Now, when Russia, what was the mood in Donetsk after Russia got involved directly? Were people more hopeful?
Oh, yeah, a lot, really. People were happy. People said that they waited for that since 8 years. That they understood that the war will end. A lot of people, of course, hoped that it would be much faster than what we see now, but there was really a lot of hope, really, because people lived in wartime for 8 years. It's really hard. They didn't see any end to that. So, yeah, people were really happy when they learned that the Russian army is arriving. it was really, really big hope and big happiness here among people, because people were really fed up about the situation and were really in a huge stress, because we understood that Ukraine wanted to attack us. People welcomed the Russian army with a lot of relief, because they understood, okay, now we will see the end of the tunnel.
How hard has this been for the young people in Donetsk?
Of course, these 8 years of war, it was hard for all the children in the Donbass, not only in Donetsk, but in all the towns. Some children, they knew only war. They are children we were born, grew up, and lived only war, so they don't know what is a peaceful life. So psychologically, yeah, it's really hard. The worst what I saw is children who lived in front lines, villages or towns. You see that these children are already like thinking like adults. They had no real childhood, and they're already really mature. To an extent, it's really hard sometimes to see their faces, because they are really serious, and you see in their eyes that they are under huge stress with shelling, that they sleep badly, that I've seen a lot of children with psychological trauma. Some children are in depression, they need to take medicines and so on. So it's really hard, of course, for them, because on the contrary of what we would think, they understand what is happening very quickly. Even children of 3-4 years, they understand what is shelling, and then they understand that it's dangerous. So it will, of course, there will be a lot of work to do with the children here after the war to repair, to cure this trauma, because there's a lot, definitely.
Yeah, no. You see the same thing, you know, in Eleanor. Now, as all this was going on, we're looking February, March, April. Were you going to the front lines a lot during this time?
I went mainly to places which were shelled and to newly liberated places. So it included some, we would say, front lines, because when I arrived in Mariupol the first time, for example, the fighting was still ongoing in the town. We went to some places where the fights were just like 50 or 100 meters from our place. I moved quite a lot as much as possible, but of course it was not possible to go really like on positions and so on like I did during the previous years, because really the fight was much more intensive, so it would be really, really dangerous.
Right. Now, at what point did you actually go to Mariupol for the first time this year?
The first time, it was mid-March. It was on the 18th, if I well remember. We entered in the western part, yes, from the western part of the town. And as I said, the fightings were still ongoing. So we were only able to go in one little block of housing building, and we were not able to go further. Like, further, the fight was still ongoing, and we heard it. So we were really like at 50 or 100 meters from the fighting. What we saw there, it's, of course, it's ruins. I mean, the town has been really destroyed by all these fightings. Mm-hmm. In very
it's kind of interesting, because, you know, the way you define at a position and the front lines. Now, you're 50 or 100 meters away from the fighting, but that's not at the position or the front line. It's 50 or 100 meters away.
Because
that's
really...
how... Go ahead.
Yeah, there, because there are some journalists which are really accompanying the troops which are advancing and which are fighting. Of course, here it's always men, because, I mean, the commanders of this unit, they would really not be able to bear the fact to lose a woman on their side, right, for that, which I understand. So there are a few, like Semyon Pegov from Argonzo, who are able to really go really close to the fight, really much closer. But it's not my case. But yeah, for me, for like 1500 meters, it's like the front line, but it's not positions, you know, it's like around the front. Well, yeah, we would say like this.
I know, but the distinction you make, most people not having done that wouldn't describe it with that precision. No, I wasn't at the front line. I was 50 meters away from it. That's, people would think, okay, I'm right here. The battle's going on. Okay, that's all I know. But, you know, that's just, I guess, from the, you know, from experience, the experience you've had doing this. Tell me, now we got to go to break right now. We're going to take this up and really talk about it after the break. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
This is George Eliason with TNT Radio, and we'll see you right after the break.
You should hear what James Breslow is talking about.
And in the hands of this president, or in the hands of the drug cartel. I mean, it seems like there's no business that they are not associated with. I mean, they're really, if people want to think about a comparison, just think about the mafia in New York, you know, where they control neighborhoods and so on. And, you know, protection money. They're going around to businesses and basically saying, if you don't want your business lit on fire by someone, we'll protect you. Just pay us every week.
That's what's happening.
I mean, in order to do business in Mexico, you are doing business with the cartels, perhaps, except for maybe the largest corporations, perhaps, right? But anything below the largest corporations, wouldn't you say?
Right, even them, they're not safe. You know, if you have a CEO of a large corporation, that guy's gonna have to hire bodyguards for his children to go to school, because they'll kidnap one of them and they'll ask for a large ransom.
James Breslow on today's News Talk TNT Radio.
Since the day I stopped drinking, my life has gotten better and better. I can't take any credit for it. It just seems that without alcohol, I think better, I'm more careful with money, I watch what I say, I don't get into trouble like I did when I was drinking. It's scary trying to walk through life alone, and today I have that very distinct feeling that I don't ever have to be alone again.
Visit AA.org for more information and download the Meeting Guide app to find a meeting near you.
When you remember this year's holiday, will you think of the waves gently lapping on the shore? The sun setting over rolling hills? Or sat, bored out of your mind with a flat tire, waiting for a recovery truck? 1 in 5 motorway breakdowns are caused by tire problems. Before you set off, check your tire pressure. Highways England.
Today's News Talk Radio. Today's News Talk Radio. TNT.
This is TNT Talk Radio. I'm your host, George Eliason, and we have Donbass war correspondent Crystal Neon with us. Thanks for coming today, too, Crystal.
You're welcome.
Now,
thanks, George.
When you first saw the city, you see all this ruin, and you start moving into it. How long did you spend there the first time?
The first time we didn't stay that much, something like maximum 2 hours, because it was really dangerous. Fighting was really nearby. We just had the time to take some pictures, made interviews with some civilians, film a bit on this big boulevard, which was at this time closed by trucks, and some barricades were done with trucks, with buses, to protect us from snipers, Ukrainian snipers, and so on. So we didn't stay that much, like maximum 2 hours, and then we left. So the first time it was really hard to see, because even there we already understood that the level of destruction of the city would be really huge. And it's due to the tactics that Ukrainian soldiers, mainly the Azov regiment, used, because they installed their firing position in flats. Or in the top of the buildings. So, of course, when the Russian army was answering, it destroyed the flats or even the whole building. And so that's why we have such a huge level of destruction in Mariupol. Like in Volnovakha, I was in Volnovakha, it was the same. The town was really completely destroyed. And there they used also the same tactics. So they even shelled from the hospital and from the hospital territory. They did the same in Mariupol with the various maternities and hospitals and so on. So they used these buildings as firing positions. And that's why there is such huge destruction. I've seen by myself also that they use schools as bases. So we found uniforms, mattresses there, like the officers' office and so on in schools in Mariupol. So we understood they have transformed all the civilian infrastructures and buildings into military targets.
Well, that's a good reason to hit them. Now, have you seen any evidence of them using human shields in Volnovakha or Mariupol?
Yeah. Because people told us that they didn't let them go. They have told them, you go in the basement and you don't move. Some people told me that they knew about some people being killed while they tried to evacuate from Mariupol. There were videos about that need to be authenticated, but you've seen when we arrived in Mariupol, the first time we saw on the road going out from Mariupol, this big highway, we saw several cars which were obviously shot at. And it was cars with Ukrainian plates. So it means some people tried to get out. The way the car was on the road, you understood the car was trying to get out of Mariupol and the car was shot. And some people confirmed us this. They told us that if they tried to get out of the basement, the soldiers told them that they have to stay there even if they had no water, even if they had no bread, nothing. They really were hiding behind civilians. As I said, they used the apartments, the flats of people. We had discussions with the Chechen soldiers who stormed Mariupol, and they told us that once even they saw one female sniper, Ukrainian, who was hiding behind a grandmother. So she was in the flat of this grandmother. She was firing from this flat, and the grandmother was inside. And they understood the grandmother was there, and to eliminate the sniper was really hard because they didn't want to kill this poor grandmother.
Right.
So we have a lot of testimonies of people who told us that the Ukrainian soldiers used them as human shields. When they used the hospitals where they were patients, the famous maternity of Mariupol, because there are several maternity of Mariupol, and all were used as firing position by the Ukrainian army. And they did that where there were women who were going to give birth there. I mean, it's just amazing. It's just and people were really, really angry after them. I had problems with YouTube because of that, because some people they told me that because of all the crimes they did, they wanted these guys to be killed. You know, they said, don't make them prisoners, kill them, you know, and it was really, it was considered as hate speech by YouTube. People told us that it was the case, and they committed even a lot of war crimes against the civilians. A lot of people told us the more we went near Azovstal at some point, the more we met people who told us that the Ukrainians themselves destroyed several buildings. They shelled some places while retreating, but Russian army was still not in this place. So there were only civilians, and they just destroyed the building for the pleasure to destroy the building. Some people reported that the Ukrainian soldiers told them, if Mariupol is not ours, then there will be no more Mariupol.
That's, yeah, we're hearing that in a lot of cities. That's just crazy. If they're not our people, then they can't be anybody's people, so they kill them.
Yeah.
Now, how were the people there reacting to DPR and Russian forces as they were cleansing Azov Battalion?
As I said, very positively, and as I said, the people in here in Mariupol, for example, were really even more radical. As I said, the Russian soldiers tried at maximum to make them prisoners. They offered them several times to surrender, but the civilians that we met were really more radical. A lot said that you should execute them. Don't even take them prisoner, just execute them.
Okay, I misunderstood you.
Yeah, I have really
I thought
a lot
that was
of
your commenters.
No.
That was really the actual civilian. People that...
People, yeah, go people ahead. Who lived through this hell in Mariupol were really harsh. I had, because of the censorship of YouTube, I had to cut some interviews because people right. said that these Azov, they treated them of parasites. They told that they are non-humans, that they should be killed, that no need to take them prisoner, just execute them. And some people had this kind of harsh words for Zelensky, for example, and others, so which I can understand, because when you see what they lived, what they had survived to, and how many people died, because a lot of civilians were killed in Mariupol, either by hunger, by lack of medicines, by shellings, by lack of everything basic, water. I mean, some people in a building near Azovstal told us that they had no water at all, and what they did is that they purged the boilers in the flats. They used the water which was in the radiators, in the heating system. You imagine drinking this? I mean,
yeah.
So a lot of people died, not only old people. There are people who died from the shelling, even in some basements, because as some civilian told us, the Ukrainian soldiers often installed a firing position near the entrance of a basement where civilians were hiding. So some basements were hit by firing, and so some people died in basements, including women, including children, including young people. So it's really so people are really really happy that, but they are even more radical than the Russian army. The Russian army is really really much soft than the civilians of Mariupol. What to do with all these Azov battalions or these mercenaries that like the ones which were condemned not long ago.
Right.
So civilians are really for a radical elimination of the Ukrainian neo-Nazis.
Now, have you talked to... Now, keep in mind, folks, this city is... Zelensky held this city up and Poroshenko before him as a beacon of a Ukrainian city. These people were supposed to have pro-Ukrainian feelings in terms of they love the government, they were treated well, they were this, they were that. And this is what they're actually saying about how they were treated. They don't want a trial. They just want to execute the people doing these things to them. Now, did you ask any of them about the last 8 years? Has this been going ongoing, or did it start with Russia's military action?
No, it was already, as a, in some areas of the town, people told us that they were not that much in contact with Ukrainian soldiers, so it depends on the area. But a lot didn't feel really safe. They were really afraid for some of them to speak in Russian. They told us that really there was a huge insecurity about that. A lot of people really made maximum not to be in contact and not to speak to the Ukrainian soldiers, especially the Azov regiment, because they told that it could degenerate really quickly. In several places, it's mainly in Svetlodarsk, but I had also this kind of testimonies from Mariupol. People told me that the Ukrainian soldiers raped women, including underage.
Reported a lot of that.
So they told that that people were really worrying about their girls and so on. So no, people didn't feel safe at all. They didn't feel safe at all. In Svetlodarsk, for example, people told me that they saw the Ukrainian soldiers were often either drunk or under narcotics, and that they had really dangerous behavior when they were like this, that they killed civilians either by shelling one each other, either by, they told us that once they were completely drunk, the Ukrainian soldiers were drunk and they were driving a tank, and they just completely crunch a car where they were a whole family. This kind of thing. So people didn't feel safe at all, not at all. And they were really into a huge stress for 8 years. People told us that they were badly treated by all these Ukrainian soldiers, and especially the neo-Nazis battalions, that they treated them of separatists, this kind of thing. So they were considered as second category citizens, you know. They were not considered like fully Ukrainian citizens by all these armed forces.
Now, you brought up narcotics, and whenever neo-Nazi battalions come up in the news, a lot of the time, the description of using narcotics or used narcotics or were drugged up or acted drugged up comes up too. Do you think this is widespread with the neo-Nazis?
I think yes, on a lot of positions, and I think even among the I would say regular troops. When we went to Svetlodarsk, for example, we stopped at the former positions of the Ukrainian army, and we found a lot of syringe. And the same in their base, which was near the town of Svetlodarsk, we found a lot. So I don't think they had a lot of diabetic people. So it's really weird. So when you see such a huge amount of syringe, you understand that they were taking narcotics. And as I said, some civilians told me that they have seen some soldiers really under drug, and the guys were really behaving extremely, like, you saw that they were not there anymore. You know that their mind was somewhere else, but not in the reality. So I think it's quite widespread in both the regular army and the neo-Nazis. There are even some neo-Nazis battalions which are doing drug trafficking, so I would not be surprised that they take it themselves.
Yeah, Pravi sector, in the areas where they took over in LNR when they were freed up, they found drug laboratories. They were manufacturing drugs. in areas that they were supposedly protecting for Ukraine. And it's been that way with them for 8 years. They started setting up shop everywhere they went. You know, and some of the other neo-Nazi battalions were complaining about it. It was so bad. You know, taking over the drug trades.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, we're going to go to break in a minute. So I don't want you to get into to anything heavy until after the break. So how many times did you go to Mariupol so far?
I think more than a dozen of time. I think perhaps 15. I have to check because I went really, easily. I went there really a lot of times, really.
I guess so. I'd like to get into, you know, a little bit each trip when we come back, okay?
Yeah.
No, that's going to be great. I just, the information that you're bringing out is just amazing. It really is. All right. This is George Eliason with TNT Radio, and we'll see you right after the break.
The midterms, and America votes on November 8th. With his expert analysis and opinion, this is TNT Radio's Jeremy Beck.
The 28th of June midterm Republican primary for Colorado's Secretary of State will be an interesting one to watch. The current Secretary of State, Gina Griswold, has been one of only two Democrats to hold this office since 1963, and the Republicans should regain the office. Leading GOP candidate Tina Peters has easily dwarfed her Republican challenges in fundraising, and she has an important endorsement from General Michael Flynn. But Tina Peters has been criminally indicted by a grand jury for illegally tampering with election equipment, among other charges, and she has also been investigated by the FBI in this matter. She insists that she is innocent and is running a massive campaign for election integrity. She describes the current Secretary of State as Gestapo Griswold and slams weaponized law enforcement and tactics to terrorize political opponents. I'm Jeremy Beck for TNT Radio.
You only put your son to bed 111 hour ago and he's woken up saying his tummy really hurts and he's got a temperature. You're worried. The 111 person you normally speak to isn't available. The surgery's closed. It's not an emergency, but you're not sure what to do. Then you remember the new free 24-hour NHS number, 111. They assess you and direct you straight away to the medical help you need. Your 111 relieved mum.
If it's not a 999 emergency, but you need medical help fast, there's now 111 number to call. When it's less urgent than 999, call 111. Now available on the Isle of Wight.
For the news and views you can't hear anywhere else.
Everybody here wants information about what's going on.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
This is TNT Talk Radio. I'm your host, George Eliason, and with me is war correspondent Crystal Neant. Welcome back, Crystal, and thanks.
You're now, welcome.
How much did you spend time at the Azovstal plant while you were in Mariupol, while that was going on?
I went closer to the Azovstal plant, but I was not able to go inside because I've lost the car at the moment. They are still cleaning mines and so on because they discover every day new mines, new traps, new... they even discovered some Ukrainian soldiers who stayed inside and thought that they could escape, you know, later. Yeah. So, and I lost my car at the moment. The other journalists began to be able to access, so I wait to be able to go there after. But I was really close. I mean, we were there several times to assess the evacuation of civilians. We even tried to film the surrender of the Azov regiment, but they didn't want to be filmed by media. So we had to get out of there to be able to let the surrender occurring. So, right. So we were not able to go there. And after, yeah, every day they found a lot of mines on all the territory. It's really, they need several weeks to clean everything because I've seen that in the Ilitsa factory. We were in this place several times. And the first time we went, we even found a grenade, a trap with a grenade. And thread, and so if we will have gone further, it would have exploded. So we have these kind of booby traps, a little bit everywhere. Yeah. They even found, because there were a lot of corpses, a lot of dead inside Azovstal, and they had put all the corpses into a frigo truck, which was not working, of course, but when they opened, the Russians opened the truck, they discovered that they have put traps and mines. So if you tried to move the corpse, it would have exploded, you know. So it's really, really dangerous, and the factory and all the basements are really big, so they need a lot of time to clear everything before journalists can go safely. I mean, I had some colleagues who went there, but like, they were a huge machine, a huge armored machine who like made a safe path, and you can go only in this path, and that's all. You cannot go right, you cannot go left. That's the end. So no, it's really, really dangerous for so they are still clearing there now. People, the journalists began to go slightly there, but there are still a lot of work because they have mine, they have everything. I mean, as I said, even the corpse. So it's really dangerous.
That you know, part of it doesn't make any sense to me at all. Okay, guys, let's surrender. Okay, just make sure you set the traps first. I mean, they're already caught. They're not going anywhere. If you know, yeah, if but something bad happens. Like this
they expect like this to make more victims on the side of the Russian soldiers and the DPR soldiers. The aim is to make a maximum of victims, even if they surrendered. So I'm not surprised at all. They have done that everywhere. Everywhere we went after some place where it was liberated, we had to wait for the deminers to work before we can access a zone, because and they find everywhere. I've seen some videos of a road. I think it was in the Kharkov region, and they were anti-tank mines posed on the roads, on the road like this. And there was a video, people filming civilian cars doing some kind of zigzag to be able to
go around the mines.
It's just completely crazy. I recently saw a video again where Russian deminers, they are on a path, and they understood that there were several mines which were put in a way with cable and a detonator. So they put like one mine, an explosive, and a second mine above it. So it's like big, so that people can imagine. It's like big cylindrical stuff. It's green, so it's like a big metallic blini. So they put one under the ground, they put an explosive with a cable going to a detonator, and then they put the second mine over it, and they found like three of them dispatched along the path, and they had to demine that. So it's just completely crazy. I mean, Russian deminers have found mines in the agricultural field, so they had to pass with a very big armored deminer machine, so that the farmers can work without danger, you know. So it's completely crazy. They for 8 years they have put mines everywhere on the front line. So there is a huge work of demining everywhere, and especially in places like Mariupol. It's just crazy. As I said, we went in Ilitsa and we found a little basement which was still not opened by anybody, and we found a booby trap, and we were, oh, okay, get out. You know?
Yeah, so, exactly. It's really crazy. 2014, one of the farmers down the street from me, he was plowing his field, and he ran over a mine with his tractor. He got injured. Thankfully, he survived, but the tractor was totaled. It was just, blown
up. It happened a lot of times here in the DPR, too. So it's really, I understand that they don't want journalists to be hurt or even worse, killed by mines. So for the moment, it's impossible to visit the Azovstal factory because of that, because of all these traps and mines that they have put everywhere. It's just crazy. And as I said, they did that for 8 years, and that's also why they had during 8 years a lot of losses among their soldiers due to their own mines, because they put them everywhere without doing a map of the minefields. Right. And so after, the guys were either driving or walking on them, and they lost a guy, and that's all. Or they lost three guys who were in the car. So it happened a lot of times, and for some people it seemed really crazy. They thought like it was like Russian propaganda or I don't know what, but it really happened a lot of times, because they were putting a lot of mines and booby traps everywhere without doing a map.
Yeah, and it's actually illegal to put mines in without a map, isn't it?
Yeah, completely. Because after, of course, it's really complicated. Because when it's in a field, it's quite easy to clean. You go with these armor deminers. They go on the field. All the mines are exploding or are taken by the system of these special devices, and that's okay. But there are places like Zaitsevo, for example. I know that there are a lot of mines in the wood.
Right.
There you cannot go with such a machine. You have to send individual deminers who will do the job, and it's really hard in a forest. So there is work for decades to clean completely the Donbas from all the mines which were put by the Ukrainian army everywhere.
Yeah, I read somewhere that Donbas is considered the most mined area in the world today.
Yeah.
Do you think that's accurate?
I think yeah. From what I see here, yeah, it's really the case. They really used a lot the mining as a defense technique, and so it's really terrible, really. As I said, I think we need for decades to clean everything, really. It's even parts of the road which is still going to, which is going to Mariupol from Donetsk. Uh-huh. There are parts you see the mine signs on the side, so you don't go a little bit on the left or on the right, and you don't go out of the car to make anything on the side. Nothing. It's really still really dangerous. Yeah.
Yeah. Actually, I think I read somewhere actually someone did pull over to the side of the road to relieve themselves and step on a mine.
It's really dangerous.
It's not an exaggeration.
It's really dangerous.
I wanted to ask you. Oh, go ahead. Okay. I wanted to ask you. Now, you've been into towns and villages that have just been freed.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about how Ukraine mines everything, and they start shelling these people after they leave, or you know, all these things happen. You know, it's mm-hmm. it's not always the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
What's it like for these people? Is it, until everything gets squared away, is it worse for them than when Ukraine was there, until Russia actually gets there or DPR gets there? More scary, maybe?
There is, of course, a more scary moment. Some people in Mariupol said, I had a woman in Mariupol who told me she has lost her flat because Ukraine soldiers were firing from her flat. So, of course, the flat was destroyed by answer firing. So she was really in a huge nervous crisis and so on. But she said, but I understand that it was the price to pay to be freed from these neo-Nazis and so on. So people are going through really scary moments because the towns which are being liberated, they are shelled by the Ukrainian army. But people
we've got about 20 seconds. Understand.
Yeah. They say that they understand that it's a price to pay to be free and for after to be part of the Russian Federation. So that's quite a strange feeling for people.